Welcome to Notes on the Mind, a podcast that explores the outer edges of human experience through the stories of people living with severe mental health problems. I'm Beth.
And I'm Tom. In this episode, we talked to Johnny Benjamin about how his mental health problems developed and impacted on his life, how an attempt to take his own life in his early 20s led to him shooting to public prominence, and how he's coped with this attention since.
As a warning, our conversation with Johnny includes frequent references to suicide. If you're struggling with thoughts about wanting to end your life, please use the Mind website to seek help. We've included a link in the episode description.
We hope you enjoy the episode. Please do let us know what you think, review and subscribe to the podcast, and share it with others.
So I'm Johnny, and I'm 34. I'm from London, and I guess I work in the youth mental health sector predominantly. I have a youth mental health charity called Beyond, and yeah, I have my own lived experience of you know, mental health issues. So when I was 20, I was diagnosed with something called schizoaffective disorder, which is kind of a combination of schizophrenia. Well, it's a combination of schizophrenia, bipolar, but I never really had the highs. The manic, do you know what I mean? I never really had that. It was more depression for me. But anyway, yeah, I got that diagnosis when I was 20, and very unwell for quite a while. But thankfully, in a very different place today.
I suppose you sort of shot to prominence when you did a campaign in 2014 about Find Mike, who actually turned out to be called Neil.
Yeah.
So this was someone who talked you down from a suicide from Waterloo Bridge 6 years prior to when you did the campaign. Is that right?
Yeah, the whole thing was kind of pretty surreal, to be honest. The campaign, like trying to find this guy that done this kind of, you know, major thing in my life. Obviously, amazing. Like, yeah. Huge. And obviously going public with my story and, you know, trying to find this guy. Yeah, it was very surreal. It was quite tough emotionally, to be honest. But the amazing thing is that you know, found this guy through the power of social media. Yeah, and then I guess the most unbelievable thing is that he now works in mental health after meeting me again, you know, being reunited. He decided to he was in the world of personal training, physical kind of health. And he completely turned his life around and started working in mental health after our meeting. And yeah, we started working together.
And how did it feel with such a, you know, I guess such a personal crisis, like a personal experience becoming very public and being in the public eye? How does that affect the way that you sort of look back at that incident?
Well, yeah, I mean, I actually became unwell a few months after I did the whole campaign and, you know, being so public. I just stopped looking after myself properly. I think I don't know, I had this weird thing of I suddenly felt like I was invincible, and yeah, I was in the media and, you know, I was getting attention, and I really stopped looking after my well-being at that point, and it quickly went downhill. I was really unwell, actually. I was back in hospital, had a psychotic episode back in hospital. And that took quite a long time to recover from, actually. It's interesting because a lot of people message me or, yeah, get in touch and say, oh, I want to share my story, mental health story, or I want to go public, I want to take it to the media. And I think I'm very, yeah, I try and be very just honest about, you know, I mean, it's great that people want to share their stories and, you know, go to the media. I think it's great, but they need to have support around them while they're doing it, I think, is really, really important. And they need to keep checking in with their well-being while they're doing it. I found dealing with journalists really, really tough. And that was, and I still do. the media's, yeah, it can be really tricky to work with some, not all journalists, but some journalists, some media outlets. So I was misquoted like a number of times, and yeah, not treated great, and that obviously impacted my mental health. So I always say to people, you know, use the support of charities and organizations when you're doing something so public and sharing your experiences. It's not easy.
Do you find it kind of amplifies the highs and lows being in the public eye and like living out some of those mental health experiences quite publicly?
Yeah, for sure. I think I'm just trying to look back and kind of remember what it was like. I think for me, it fed into my, with part of my like schizoaffective diagnosis, a symptom is delusion. And I think for me, it wasn't so much highs and lows. It maybe fed into my sort of delusional kind of symptoms a bit, being in the public eye, getting noticed. And then, you know, the paranoia side as well, I think. It's sort of pretty complex, actually. So I, you know, growing up, I had this, what we call the Truman delusion. People that believe they're on the Truman Show, the film, the Truman Show, Jim Carrey's film. So I had that growing up. I had this belief I was being watched by cameras and I was on this TV show. And so then actually becoming, going on to TV and having cameras in front of you when I was doing this campaign. I don't know, it sort of set something off, not in a good way. Yeah, I've got to be really careful, you know, when I'm doing things like media or talking to journalists, and I can get really sort of carried off in my imagination.
Well, it's like something, I suppose, that you were, when you were having these beliefs that you were on the Truman Show, and then suddenly having all of the cameras around, that you know, that was your reality, that I guess a lot of people might not experience both those things. So they are so similar. I imagine it would add quite a lot of, pressure to a situation that was already fairly stressful.
Yeah, I think for me it was, you know, I had this like time when I believed I was in the Truman Show, the cameras were watching me. And then obviously when I was 20, I got this diagnosis and, you know, kind of everything. I realized that I wasn't chosen. I wasn't on a TV show. I was, it was an illness or whatever. So I had that. And then I then had the Find Mike campaign where I was really in the cameras, and so it was all just a bit really overwhelming, I think, kind of going from like different extremes. And you know, I started to get like recognized out in public, and I always thought that I'd like that, but actually I found it really uncomfortable. And I found that I don't know, that because I, as well, I think what made it worse is that my mental health started to decline quite rapidly. But people were, you know, coming up to me saying, you know, you're doing so well now, it's great. And so I felt I had this pressure to, and even journalists would say to me, well, you know, everything's great for you now, isn't it? And I was lying to them, because I wasn't doing great, but I felt I had to keep up this sort of appearance that I was, you know, people, you know, would say to me, you're an inspiration, you offer hope to people. And I was like, oh my gosh, like, you know, I've got to be okay. I have to be okay, because people need me be okay around me, that expect me to be okay now I've kind of gone public. And I felt this pressure. I mean, most of it was from me, but I definitely felt this pressure that I just had to be okay now, because, you know, I'd come through the other side with this whole journey. And even when I, you know, I started to give talks, you know, people would come up at the end and say, well, it's great, you're all fine now. And it, you know, yeah, I found that really tough. I found that really hard. And the more I did, the more I felt I had to put on this almost, mask, which was ridiculous, because I was like, you know, I was telling other people to be honest about their mental health, and yet I wasn't being honest about my own. So the whole thing was just a bit of a mess in my head.
Can I just ask, when you said, so it started with this belief, or your experience of feeling that you were in the Truman Show, at what point did you notice that things sort of started to change for you, and that perhaps, like, well, I guess other people weren't having that experience, or that it was an unusual experience in any way? Was there a point that you started to notice that, or did you sort of just take it in your stride when it first began?
For me, it first began when I was like 10. And the thing for me was that because the Truman Show came out, I think it was 1997. I think it was. So I was 10. So I was moving from primary to secondary. It was quite a stressful time. And I was moving from a really small primary school to a really big secondary school. Mm. And it all happened around the same time. And I also lost my grandmother, and I was really close to her. And so I come from a Jewish family, and I went to a Jewish school. And there's this thing in the Jewish faith and other faiths where it's like, right, we've buried the person, we've mourned, let's go on with our lives. And I just couldn't do that. And I don't know, I was struggling. And then I saw this film, The Truman Show, and I went to the movies with my best friend. And my best friend, he after we saw that film, he started to kind of put the idea into my head that I was on my own version of the Truman Show, because he'd do things like, I don't know if you've seen the film, but in the film there's a lot of like product placements. So the characters will, they'll be holding something and they'll be like, oh, you should try this product. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Jim Carrey's character doesn't realize, but they're trying to obviously advertise to the wider audience. So my friend would do that with stuff. And like, there were things that he would say to me and I just started to question everything. And the idea of being in this TV show was really appealing because I started this school and I just could not make friends. I don't know, I've really struggled. It was, yeah, like this massive school. I didn't seem to gel with anyone. I felt very lonely. And then I started to think, if I'm on this TV show, then, oh my gosh, people will know me and they'll like me. And, you know, I will be somebody. I always wanted to be somebody. So the idea was really appealing of being on this TV show. It wasn't like a scary thing or it was actually something that I wanted because I felt really lonely. And this show was a way, or believing that I was in this show was a way of kind of getting rid of that loneliness.
Just sort of a form of escapism, perhaps.
Yeah, but yeah, absolutely. A form of escapism that then became, you know, like I started to just like misread things. So I don't know, I'd be thinking of someone in my head, as you do, and then they'd be there, like in the school corridor. And I'd be like, wow, you know, they're in my head and they know and they're planting everything and everything revolves around me. Or there'd be a song that was, you know, in my head and it would come on the radio and I'd be like, right, another bit of evidence that they are in my head and that they are making this whole thing around me. And like when I went on holiday, I was like, well, you know, obviously they're building the set and, you know, I know it sounds silly, but yeah, you know, all these people in the hotel are obviously actors and it's amazing how the mind is just so powerful and what it can sort of lead you to believe.
So there's like an interesting theory around how psychosis or like psychosis-like symptoms develop, which is that people get into this kind of cycle of misinterpreting or overinterpreting kind of signals and experiences they're having. They become more alert to those things, and the more alert to them they are, the more they interpret them. And so basically it's kind of this idea that rather than it being a kind of, you know, your brain's broken and you've gone psychotic, it's the idea that this stuff can develop over time. And that sounds a bit like what you were talking about there, but does that ring true?
Yeah, it does. And, you know, I mean, the differences between now and then is that now, because, you know, stuff comes into my head and, I remember saying to my psychiatrist not that long ago, like, there's something going on with me and the weather. Like, whenever I feel low, the weather turns bad. And when I feel okay, the weather seems better. So, you know, what is going on, like, with me and the weather? And I told my psychiatrist and, you know, my psychiatrist and my therapist, I'm very, very, very lucky. You know, I'm very open with them about these things and they can very quickly sort of put me on the right track. And that's the difference between, yeah, now and when I was a teenager, when, you know, things would come into my head and yeah, I'd misinterpret them. I remember once I went into a shop and I needed a new laptop, and I was looking at the laptops and I just looked at the most expensive one, and then my favorite song came on and I was like, that's a sign, I have to buy it. I can't afford it, but I have to buy it because, you know, my favorite song's come on. And yeah, it's very easy for me to get kind of caught up in my head, and I need someone there to be like, you know, Johnny, no, like, you know, this is, don't get sucked into it. And this is what's really going on. Do you know what I mean?
Mm. How did things kind of culminate from kind of those initial beliefs about things like being on a TV show to get to a point where you ended up being in hospital? Kind of what was that process from kind of almost quite kind of innocent beliefs to things getting more serious?
Well, for me, it changed around my mid-teens. And I think I know it's got a lot to do with struggling with my sexuality and, you know, again, coming from a Jewish. So I started to get, coupled alongside the Truman sort of delusion was this, I call it, the voice of what I thought was an angel. And that stems a lot from, you know, growing up Jewish, being very obsessive about the religion and doing right and wrong, and believing that I had some sort of like connection with God, and I had this angel that was with me. And again, maybe that sort of started after my grandmother passed away. Maybe there is a connection there with that and the angel. And but when I was in my mid-teens, the angel changed to what I believed was the devil. And that's when things went really kind of sour, because this voice started telling me to do things. And it literally took over my life. Like, I would have to say certain things, or otherwise bad things would happen. And everything, like, as it always often does, you know, it started off very small. Like, just do this, like, touch something, or, you know, something bad will happen.
Yeah.
And then it just became more and more constant and more pressurized to do these things, and it became more and more distressing. And so then everything then turned, well, I guess that's when the sort of depression hit, and suddenly everything wasn't so, you know, suddenly everything went wrong at that point. And it was around the same time I started to question my sexuality, and I started to, you know, believe I was a bad person because I wasn't straight, and you know what? Yeah. And then ultimately it culminated in a psychotic episode where I believed I was being taken over. And I had this weird experience where I went onto the streets. Well, I actually went into, I ended up in the middle of like a dual carriageway, and I was like preaching to these, all the cars that were going past. And like, that is not me. Like, it's so weird. Like, stuff was, I was like screaming and shouting at these cars, and felt like I was completely sort of taken over.
Mm.
And that experience led me to a psychiatric hospital and getting this diagnosis of schizoaffective disorder, which just sort of, well, I think it was the diagnosis. I think it was being put into a hospital, being put into a suicide ward. I spent a month in there before I went to the bridge, because I'd just given up by that point. I'd really kind of, and having to like deal with or not deal with my sexuality, it was too much at that point. And I wanted out by then.
Had you spoken to anyone about your thoughts about your sexuality at the time, or about the voice of the, you know, what you felt was the devil at that time when those two things were happening?
Well, I mean, some of my friends, some of my friends actually one night took me to A&E. I was in a really bad way. So I sort of had to sort of confess to my friends. They didn't know what to do. It was really difficult for them. And then so I went into hospital, and I spoke to my psychiatrist, but again, like, he just never really had time. Like, you know, he'd come and see me every day in the psychiatric unit, and it was always very quick. And he would just really talk to me about my medication, and because, you know, I was immediately put on antipsychotics and antidepressants, like a load of pills. People just didn't really have time, or they were there to just watch me because I was on this suicide ward. And, you know, people were there just to, they weren't there to talk. They were really there just to watch me. And so it was difficult for me to be with someone and really like be given the time to open up, if that makes sense.
Mm. Mm. Did you find you got any benefit from being there?
No, unfortunately. The thing was as well, everyone around me was really unwell. Like, so I was in, the first time I was in hospital, it was Christmas. And I don't know, there was a massive influx of patients actually. Like around the time of Christmas, just after Christmas, in the lead up to the new year, there was a lot of people being admitted, and like really unwell people. And yeah, just everyone just seemed unwell. No one seemed to be getting any better. It was really bleak, to be honest. When I felt like really suicidal and I tried to talk about it, they would like be right, well, we need to medicate you.
Mm.
And I don't know, just I stopped talking, I think, to be honest.
When you did leave the hospital and went to the bridge, you said that it kind of felt like the only way to achieve peace. And it's quite common for people who kind of think about taking their own life to talk about not wanting to live rather than wanting to die necessarily. Does that ring true for you? And I guess how quickly did you kind of transition from kind of thinking about these things and having these feelings to kind of deciding this was something you want, you know, that you were intending to do?
I'd had suicidal ideation really since I was like 16, 17. Mm. And then it just, I mean, as the years went on, it just appeared more and more, I'd say. Mm. And then particularly when I got into the hospital, they were just really, it was very intense. But I think for me, so the night before I decided to run away, there was this weird, like, sort of something clicked in my mind where these thoughts turned from just thoughts into, no, let's do this. And then I felt this weird sense of, like, almost calm, if that makes sense. Because everything was just so messed up in my head. And, yeah, I finally had a way out. And so then I suddenly felt this, like, weird, calmness, I guess. And that might sound weird, but that's the best way to describe it. Yeah, because I had a plan and I knew what time I'd leave the hospital and what I was going to say. And everything was just mapped out. And it just, everything seemed a bit, that peace that you mentioned, everything seems a little bit more peaceful, to be honest.
Do you think there was something in the sort of, just when you were talking, it was like all the distressful experiences you were having and the sort of uncertainty of what if and when it was going to improve. And then when you were talking, it's like you had this plan and there was like a degree of certainty. I think there was some sort of relief or like respite from that in knowing that there was just certainty in something.
100%. I mean, yeah, because, you know, my psychiatrist was saying, we don't know how long you're going to be here. We don't know what's going to happen to you. And you know, there was also, you know, suddenly my family and friends as well were, you know, everything was out in the open. And I think there was a lot of embarrassment and shame. And yeah, with this sort of plan, it was just all, everything, all that uncertainty and all that shame and all that embarrassment and all the fear of like, well, what am I going to do now with my life? And everything just went because I had a plan and there was a way to resolve, like, all the unresolvable.
Do you think there is anything, when you're in the hospital and you're in that environment, do you think there is anything that could have been done or you've thought about since that might have helped to, although there couldn't be some sort of certainty, that could have given you some hope that would have taken you on a different path?
I think if I'd have been with someone that said, you know, I've been there and I've got through it.
Mm.
I really think that, because I really didn't believe I was going to get through it. And as I said, everyone else was really unwell. There was not one person that was doing okay. Everyone was in a really bad way. And yeah, I just wish there would have been one person who was able to say, look, yeah, I've been there, but I've come out the other side, or it does get better. Yeah, that might have helped me to, just to realise that, you know, that there is hope. I think, yeah, it was, like I said, it was just so bleak. It was so bleak and there was no hope. There was just no hope in that unit at all.
Going back to when you were on the bridge, before Neil intervened, do you remember kind of actively weighing up the decision, or were you kind of dead set and about to act at the point that Neil intervened?
Well, I mean, I've got quite like hazy memory. I remember running out of the hospital and I said I needed a cigarette and they let me out and I'm, you know, sort of ran away. And I remember some of the journey. So I traveled up from the hospital to the bridge. And I remember some of the journey and, you know, just reflecting a lot on thinking about my family a lot and almost praying that to take some guilt away. Mm. You know, I was really, I was thinking about that a lot. I don't have a very good memory of getting off the train, going on to the bridge. From what I sort of remember roughly, it wasn't long. Like, there wasn't much time between me going, like, you know, stepping over the barriers and then this person being there. I remember a lot of fear of, you know, of the height.
Mm.
You know, I was like, oh my gosh, wow, this is it. And this is really high. And yeah, there's the water a long way down. I remember that sort of fear. And then there was this person there next to me, talking to me.
Hmm.
Can you remember what it was that he said that helped you to change your mind?
Again, I it's I remember more like not so much maybe the words, but more sort of the kind of feeling, if that, you know, the sense of it, like the sense of, like, it felt different, this interaction to, you know, the interactions that I've been having in the hospital. There was something different about him. His way of being with me was just really, he was just very, well, I know I've used this word, human, like with his interaction was very like, he was a young guy. He was like a bloke, like a sort of mate. And I don't know, the way he was talking to me was, it wasn't clinical at all. I remember, because in the hospital, obviously, you know, there was a lot of sort of clinical talk where, you know, people would come in with their clipboards and, you know, I'd be asked to tell the person something on a scale of 1 to 10, how I was feeling about this. Or, you know, with this guy, it was nothing like that. It was just like, it felt very kind of, yeah, as I say, just like a chat, just like really informal. He was really calm, just really calm and sort of collected. And, you know, he says now he had no idea what to, he didn't have any training. So, you know, for him, it was just like, just constantly like, you know, am I doing the right thing, or what should I say here? Or, you know, let me just listen. But, if, you know, for me, it just seemed, there was a lot of, you know, space and, you know, some silences and pauses. There seemed to be time and space. And as I think as well, I felt really listened to and kind of understood. No judgment. There was no judgment there. But yes, there was the listening and the sort of present, just being present. But then there was the stuff that he said. Yeah, for sure. And I guess the thing that I really, again, I don't remember the exact words, but I remember this positivity. He is a very positive person, and that made a difference. I remember on the edge of, I mean, obviously I was in a state of complete sort of despair and, you know, but there was, he managed to sort of maintain his positivity. He was really encouraging, you know, he was saying things like, you know, I think you'll be all right. And I really think that made a big difference. Like, cause he was, you know, I think he really stuck by that I would be all right. And even though I was saying, you know, I was obviously, my head was in such a horrendous place and I was thinking, you know, jumping, he still maintained that I would be okay. And eventually he managed to convince me to come off the edge. This was January 2008. It was freezing, like really grim winter's day. And I was just in a t-shirt. So I was just shivering. Basically, he said, I'll buy you a coffee and, you know, and we can chat. And yeah, eventually I agreed. I felt safe and with this guy, and I felt this connection. I felt, yeah, I want to carry on this chat. I feel a bit different, yeah, from him, you know, just being there and talking. And so, yeah, and so eventually I came off the edge. At that point, that I didn't know where the police were waiting, and the police quickly sort of intervened, and it went from sort of really calm to really frantic in like a second.
You talked about a kind of sense of relief when you'd made the decision to take your own life. Was there any sense of relief having kind of been talked down from that point?
I don't know, no, maybe not a sense of relief, but maybe just not alone in that state, because I felt so alone in that. Well, everything that I'd been going through, I felt so alone, but I had a bit of connection with this guy. And for the first, like, there was no connection with anyone in that hospital, even with my family that came to visit. It was just really awkward and we didn't know what to say. And but with this guy, finally, after such a long time, there felt like this sense of connection with someone. And things still felt, you know, unstable, you know, uncertain. But at least, I don't know, there was something about feeling connected and like almost safe with it. I felt safe for the first time in a long time with this guy. And he offered me these, you know, these words of hope, you know, you'll get better. And something definitely shifted. But you know, as I said, with the police sort of suddenly intervening, that all just sort of went really like very quickly, because it was just a very sort of different interaction with the police as with the guy, completely different.
Did you return to hospital after this point then?
I did, yeah. From that point, I was sectioned. Again, going back to what you said, Tom, like I definitely didn't feel relief. I felt embarrassed, especially with my psychiatrist. My psychiatrist was, I don't know, he was disappointed. He said he was disappointed and hadn't said anything. And Maybe he didn't mean to, but I felt bad about everything. Because I returned to the hospital and everything was the same. The people were still really unwell. But it was almost like I had a little bit of light that was shone from this guy, him offering this bit of hope. Something had just a little bit had shifted in me going back, you know. Just that little bit of light, a little bit of hope had sort of given me enough to push me on.
Mm.
You know, said, right, I just want to get out of this hospital. I'm just going to do my best to get out of here. Even if that means sort of, you know, having to maybe not tell the truth about suicidal ideation, just because I want to get out. Do you know what I mean?
Mm.
And it's probably not the best way to go, but I guess I felt a sense of a determination, which is good.
Were you still having those thoughts? And was there a point after that in the ensuing days and weeks where you kind of thought about trying again?
No, I honestly think that the chat on the bridge, and so I'm sure that he won't mind me saying, because he talks about it himself now, but Neil, the guy on the bridge, said that he'd also been in, not in the same place as me, but a similar place. And again, I don't know why. I don't know. It just really, you know, it's weird sitting here talking about this now at the age of 34 in 2021, because I know so many people around me that have struggled, and, you know, they're very open. But honestly, when, you know, this was 2007, 2008, I was 20, 21. I literally knew no one had ever opened up to me about struggling with their mental health or having a diagnosis like schizoaffective or anything like that. But this guy did start to, you know, open up and had come out the other side, because, you know, he'd come out the other side. And I think I did feel, yeah, a little bit more, okay, well, you know, I'm not alone, actually. And someone has gone through it and come out the other side. So, you know, I just think things weren't as intense. You know, obviously things were still there, like suicidal thoughts and feelings, but just things felt less intense, if that makes sense, because I'd met someone that had been there and got through it, and maybe I could too. But, I mean, you know, things were still there, and it took a long time for things to be resolved. But yeah, I think less intensity, I think, maybe.
And if you have sort of periods of having suicidal ideation now, do you feel like you've found sort of effective, you know, as we call them, coping strategies or ways of dealing with them? Or is it just about sort of talking to people? Because it sounds like before, when you first started experiencing all of these sort of difficulties with your mental health, am I right in thinking that when you were sort of 16 up until the period you're in hospital, you didn't really feel like you were able to talk to people about it?
Yeah. For sure, 100%. I think as well, and I know I've said this before, but coming from a Jewish background, going to a Jewish school, I think, you know, again, in some faiths, there is more stigma. And, you know, in my faith, in my community, there was so much like, you've got to be your best self, like kind of a bit like Instagram in real life. Like, you know, in definitely in the Jewish community where I live, it's like, it's all about having the best job, the best house, the best car, the best, like, you've always got to be like showing your best self. And so when I started struggling, I was like, I really can't show this at all. Whereas now I still have periods of definitely, yeah, suicidal ideation for sure. But yeah, I do talk about it now, particularly with my therapist. So my therapist, I have a CFT therapist, compassion focused therapy. I've been having CFT for a few years actually, and I've been with the same therapist, and he's amazing. Like, I literally can talk to him about literally anything, and never judges, always has some insight and wisdom. And yeah, when it comes to, you know, suicidal thoughts and feelings, I just know I can always vocalize them with him, and yeah, it makes such a difference. I still get, you know, a bit embarrassed, and yeah, I still find it hard to communicate, but I know now that I, again, like with, you know, delusional thoughts, I just have to be a bit courageous and just talk about them.
But you're right in what you were saying just before as well, is that, I mean, the conversation around mental health has changed so much in the last, I mean, 5-10 years, in that generally people, you know, not to say everywhere, and it's definitely not perfect, but people do generally feel more comfortable, especially younger generations, talking about the fact that, you know, we can all experience difficulties with our mental health in some form. You know, when you've been talking throughout about some of the experiences around the, you know, as you've described, like delusional beliefs, do you feel like it's ever harder to talk about those sort of experiences, I guess the ones that might be under the sort of umbrella of psychosis, compared to the experiences you have that are associated with depression, because I guess sort of publicly a lot more people might be able to understand depression, whereas for the majority of people, you know, the beliefs like thinking you're in the Truman Show and the sort of hearing voices, a lot of people can't relate to. So yeah, do you feel like in your sort of public work you feel like you sort of veer towards talking about some of your more, yeah, the experiences that other people might associate with more?
Well, no, I think in my sort of public, when I'm speaking publicly, like giving a talk, I will try and just be really honest about, you know, all my experiences. But I'd say when I'm struggling though, and I'm having to talk to people around me, I do find it much harder to talk about the psychotic symptoms rather than, yeah, symptoms of depression. And again, I guess I've learned over the years who to talk to about certain things. I know who will understand, who won't understand. I know who will offer empathy, who just, you know, will quickly try and, you know, change the subject. And yeah, I guess I've learned and again, I feel very lucky that, you know, I know who to go to when I experience certain things and what I can say with that person and not say with that person. And again, I'm, you know, lucky that I can literally say anything to my therapist in particular and also my psychiatrist. I feel that there's a lot of people that don't have that. You know, I've given a lot of talks and, you know, people have come up at the end and, you know, they'll whisper it in my ear, or they'll wait till everyone else goes out of the room and they'll say, yeah, I've got schizoaffective disorder as well. Whereas I feel like if it's depression and anxiety, you know, things that are, yeah, more widely spoken about, they're more open. They're much more open in front of colleagues and peers. And I'd say the same is, you know, like borderline personality disorder as well. Again, it's, you know, people will be much more maybe embarrassed about sharing that, as opposed to, yeah, depression and anxiety. Even bipolar, I think, because bipolar is talked about much, much more. You know, we've got high profile people that have spoken about bipolar, but yeah, something like schizoaffective, or we're still kind of missing high profile figures talking about that.
Can you see us getting to a point where, you know, we can talk about psychosis the same way we talk about depression and anxiety?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, for sure. So, you know, with my charity, we've got this youth board of around 30 young people, all who have different experiences, from, yeah, psychosis to BPD. And I mean, the way they talk about it, like, I mean, I could never have spoken like that when I was in my teens or 20s, or, you know, even really early 30s. I just couldn't talk like the way they talk now. It's quite amazing that, I mean, you know, I can think of a few people on our youth boards who were in their late teens, early 20s, who have diagnosis of schizophrenia, schizoaffective, BPD. And they're just so sort of open, whether that be, you know, to us at the charity or on their Instagram pages or on TikTok, you know, and they're making these amazing videos on TikTok of how to describe what's going on in their heads. I mean, it's really, yeah, it's really incredible. So I do feel like things are definitely moving in the right direction, 100%. And they will continue to. There's no, we can't move backwards. You know, we can only move forwards. I really believe that. I feel really positive about, yeah, the future and the next generation. Things are so different now. I mean, there's still a long way to go, don't get, you know, there's still a long way to go, but I do feel really, really sort of encouraged by the conversations that are taking place.
Can I just jump back quickly just to ask one more thing about, I guess, kind of having been through quite extreme states, I guess, of feeling suicidal at times and having, like you're talking about, quite unusual beliefs at times. Do you find it hard to kind of empathize with yourself from between those states, or to kind of reconcile yourself with having been through such, I guess, unusual experiences?
Well, I guess that's where CFT comes in handy, because, you know, CFT, compassion focused therapy, is all very much focused on that self-compassion, self-forgiveness, I think, is a key bit of CFT. My therapist, actually, in particular, Charlie, works a lot with people who have psychosis, and he's really able to unlock that empathy. So, you know, we'll do an exercise where he'll get me to talk to my angry self, or my anxious self, and then talk to my compassionate self. And I think at the beginning, I found it really difficult to tap into that compassionate side. But, you know, over time and practice, I think it's got easier, where I can have a conversation with that compassionate self. And yeah, maybe resolve, you know, if I've had a relapse, if I've gone into hospital, if I've been suicidal, you know, I can talk to that sort of compassionate side, and, you know, we can, yeah, kind of resolve what's happened. I think, you know, I know a lot of people that maybe go through relapses, and then, you know, they come out and they're just like, right, done, don't want to think about that, don't want to. And I, you know, that works. I think that works, you know, maybe that works for some people, but I think for me it's really important to, like, yeah, sort of process some, if I've been through something and what I've learned and what I can maybe take away, you know, for the future, rather than, you know, just be like, right, don't want to think about that, that's done, move on. I think as well, I haven't mentioned, but, you know, having sort of spiritual practice or something like mindfulness for me has been really helpful. I think I, you know, I kind of, growing up in, you know, religious community, I lost a lot of my relationship with my faith when I became unwell, sort of ditched that. But, you know, I always wanted to connect to something spiritual, and then finding mindfulness and, you know, maybe Buddhism to a certain extent has really helped. And finding, you know, communities as well within that, I think, is really helpful. I belong to, like, different communities, actually, like mindfulness groups or, yeah, meditation circles or whatever it is. And I think, yeah, being part of that is really helpful as well.
What is it about mindfulness that you find so helpful?
Well, I think, you know, again, this has been a massive journey. It's been a massive process, because at the beginning I was like, I can't do mindfulness. I can't meditate. I just can't do it. But again, like, you know, being patient with myself and, you know, being sort of gentle on myself with it. It's kind of like, you know, if you're working on something physically, you know, like going to the gym to build a muscle, you know, it takes time and it takes dedication and and I realize that now. It's the same when it comes to mindfulness, like, you know, it's about training the mind, isn't it? To be more present and to be more here now in the moment. For me, that's it. It just, anything that kind of gets me out of my head and allows me to be more present and in my body, and anything that can sort of quieten down the mind, for me, it's really helped. I remember the first time I ever did, like, a meditation, I had this, like, unbelievable sense of, like, peace of mind that I'd never had before, where, like, I was listening to the birds, enjoying the birds singing, and, like, that might sound weird, but that had never happened before, where I'd been able to sit and enjoy the birds, because there'd always been noise in my head. But finally, just being able to sit, be really present, enjoy the birds singing, it was like, wow, like, this is, it kind of unlocked so much when that happened.
You've kind of taken your experiences and focused on how you can help others who are experiencing mental health problems. How much is that kind of sense of purpose and mission around the work that you do, how much does that play a part in helping you to stay well?
Yeah, I think it really helps me to stay well, for sure, 100%. I mean, you know, when I was unwell last, yeah, at the end of 2020, it was tough, and I took time out of work, of my charity. But the really great thing is that, you know, the charity people are now running that charity, and, you know, it can continue almost without me. So there was always a sense of, even though I'm not well enough to do anything, you know, I have got purpose, because, you know, my charity is doing good things. And I think that really helped me, because that was always what I really struggled with initially in my 20s, was I'm ill, I don't have purpose, I can't do anything. But now, yeah, having this sense of, well, even when I'm not well enough to do something, at least, you know, my sort of community, if you want to, is still going, it's still moving ahead. And even if I have to leave it for, like, 3-4 months, it's still gonna go, and we're helping people. So again, you know, I always say to people, you know, to sort of try and find a community, or whether that be online or maybe in person. I mean, you know, like, the charities like Mind and Rethink, you know, they all have local kind of hubs, and, you know, finding out what's going on in that community, I think, can be really, really useful. Because, yeah, I think that sense of sort of having no purpose, I mean, it really does, for me, it really impacted my mental health negatively for a long time.
Thank you so much for your time, Johnny, and for talking about such sensitive issues with such honesty and openness. We really appreciate it.
No, it's a pleasure. Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Notes in the Mind. As we said at the start, please do use the Mind website to seek help if you've been affected by the issues we've talked about. We've included a link in the episode description.
Please do let us know what you thought of the episode. Review and subscribe to the podcast and share it with others. You can find us on Twitter @notesonthemind_.
We'll be back soon with a new episode, but until then, take care of yourself.